AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to Let's Commiserate. I am your host, Sam.
And I am Dave.
And I want to get your thoughts on something before we really get into this here.
Did you get another keyboard?
No, but I want to. I really want to. Side note, Keep Talk, absolutely no response
at all.
From nothing.
Nobody in the community?
Keep Talk will, like, or at least, I don't know, TikTok.
Post anything? Did you?
Yes, I did a clip from
I saw that.
And
IG.
And for, you know, we have videos on TikTok that get thousands and thousands and thousands of views. That keyboard clip, it's at like 150 views.
Wow.
Either TikTok is just like, Sam, you are only allowed to talk about murder mysteries or Star Wars and nothing else.
They're like, stay in your lane.
I am being ghosted. I'm really being ghosted by the Keep Talk community, but I will never give up. I will never stop trying.
Keep fighting.
No, this came into my mind over the weekend, and I was realizing, you know how I always know when a party is about to get awkward? When somebody says, hey, I think I'm going to order some pizza.
Ooh.
Because why is it? Why is getting pizza at parties so awkward? Because there's all of a sudden,
No, okay, just walk me through this. So you're, you know,
for
all the people that don't get invited to parties. So you're at a gathering.
No,
you're yinging out with people.
Yeah. Or it could be you knew ahead of time, like, hey, we're all getting together for movie night. We're going to get pizza. Oh, so-and-so, can you bring drinks, chips, etc.? But any other food item, it doesn't matter. Like when somebody invites you over for like a roast chicken dinner.
Okay.
You think nothing of it, but when somebody orders pizza, you feel obligated to be like, so how much?
So this is a money thing.
Money thing, eating thing, principle-based thing. But why is it when somebody orders pizza, you all of a sudden feel inclined to go and ask like, hey, so do you want me to send you something like on Venmo or whatever, like,
because it's paid for food.
Yes, but so is when you have people over, when you cook a meal for them, that's also paid for food.
Yeah, but it's cheap. And typically you ask, hey, what can I bring? And it's like, hey, can you bring a side? Hey, can you bring, you know, chips or a drink or, you know, or something else. That's your contribution. But the thing is, they're not asking you to bring a side. They're asking you to chip in for the price of the meal.
Unless they have already asked you to bring something else in addition to the pizza. Hey, can you bring soda?
Then why do you feel guilty?
Because that's my question. Why do we still feel a measure of guilt when it comes to pizza?
Well, so are you bringing sides to the what? Pizza does not need sides. Pizza is the whole.
Pizza and wings?
Okay.
Hello?
See, that's all you need.
Chips,
mm-hmm.
Soda,
wait.
Pizza and pizza and beer.
Pause, rewind. So you're ordering wings and pizza from separate places?
No, you usually get them from the same place.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So that you don't need sides.
You know, or if somebody wants to get the sides or the wings or something like that.
Or typically people bring, hey, can you bring a salad? We're going to have pizza and wings there.
Well, it's happened before too, where like I've been at a party where pizza was served and someone's like going to get the pizza, like, hey,
I don't know why this conversation is making me anxious.
Right?
Because just that, maybe you're right. Maybe it is.
It's like you go to get pizza or like someone else is getting pizza. Like, hey, who ordered this? Like, who should I talk to about like giving cash to or something? When I will say, if I'm throwing a party where I'm exclusively ordering pizza, nothing else is going to be served.
No.
I don't expect, or like if I'm only ordering pizza, and maybe if I'm ordering like more than three pizzas, then I might say like, if anybody wants to contribute, like, just cash at me or whatever.
Pizza has gotten expensive. I don't know if it's just inflation or price gouging or what, But I know growing up, like a large cheese pizza and a drink or a side or something, it was an even $20.
Right. Yeah.
Even that was like a cheese pizza should be $12.
Yes.
Now, I mean, like a cheese pizza is 25 plus tax.
Well, then I feel like
not including top, like that's just a bare bones cheese pizza. If you want extra cheese or meat, or if you do any form of like a pizzeria specialty, like Grandma's Pizza or the Annihilator, the Meat Lover, you know, whatever. Any of those, they're going to be a good 40.
When you go to a party and it's like everybody's brought a dish and it's kind of buffet style and people are going up and taking their items like mac and cheese or a piece of chicken, nobody is paying attention to the portions you are taking.
No.
But for some reason, when you go up to take from the pizza box, all of a sudden it feels like all eyes are on you. Look, how many slices is he about to take? How many slices is he about to grab? How much did he contribute? He's taken 3 slices.
Yeah.
I bet he only sent like $5 for his contribution. What?
You know, that's a fair. I hadn't thought about this. Okay. Did this happen recently? Were you at a party this week?
It wasn't. I mean, like, and I'm sure the only one thinking about it this much was me. But we were with Samantha had some family members visiting and her cousin. We like there was already a ton of food and snacks there. Like people had already gotten wings and, you know, it was just apps. Her cousin said, "Hey, are there any good pizza spots around here? I think I might just order a pizza." And I was like, OK, like we are going to order pizza, or like you're going to order pizza. Like,
are we feeling a little courageous? Are we all going
to? But it's like, but like, how are we doing this? I feel like, do we need to write up a contract? Like you are ordered. This was your idea.
You started this.
This was not part of the original plan.
Train is now in motion.
So am I going to be judged if I partake of your pizza without contributing?
Yeah.
And when in actuality, he was probably just like, I just wanted a pizza. But so he ordered a medium pepperoni pizza.
Who gets a medium?
I know, that's first mistake.
Okay.
There were only...
And a small if you're doing a personal pizza, but you always do the large.
Well, there were only 6 of us there.
Oh.
And 3 of them, or I think it might have just been me and him, were the only ones who actually wanted the pizza. And so he picks up the pizza, pays for it. They're like, oh, Sam, go get some pizza. I'm like, some?
This is a trap.
I'm like, some pizza or...
What? How much is some?
Yeah.
Is that one slice?
So I played it safe with one slice. It was yummy. And then after some time, I'm like looking around and people see my plate is empty. I feel like all eyes are on me like, is he about to do it? And so I said, I think I'm just gonna go get another slice. So, and I felt like Samantha was looking at me like... Boy, did you contribute? Did you send him money or anything?
Film a skit like this, and we'll have like the overlays of the narration of people's thoughts.
Yeah, nobody seemed to be bothered by it. But then this leads to the ultimate question: how do you tackle the last slice of pizza?
Oof.
Are you gonna be that guy?
You just gotta man up.
Are you gonna be that guy?
Okay. The white man in me is just saying, like, you got to go up there and you got to say something. Be like, I don't mind. You know, somebody's got to finish this. You just put the quip. You just put, like, one of those closer sentences on it. And then you can take the last slice. Well, this is going to go cold. You take the slice. You say, if nobody else is going to.
Well, you know, in that moment, everybody may be laughing. But in their heads, they're like, what a jerk. Did you see the jerk?
Okay, the other alternative is the point and ask. Like, hey, do you want any more pizza? Do you want it? But the thing is, you risk them saying.
Yeah, I do.
Being like, hey, Sam, do you want the last slice? Or you could alternatively go with, hey, do you want half of this?
That is the
shared misery. That's the shared experience. And it's like we both suffer, but we both suffer equally.
Also, how long? How long has this last slice been sitting there?
I think that's the real question.
But see, I handle the last slice the exact opposite way that you said, like making a scene of it. I handle it like a covert operation, like I'm going to steal the Declaration of Independence. I like make sure, like
I can see the meme now. I'm gonna do it. I'm going to steal the last life episode.
I make sure absolutely everybody has cleared out of the kitchen, or I might create a diversion, like in the living room. Like, guys, watch this YouTube video. Oh, this is hilarious. Like, then I'll go sneak off. Maybe like wolf down that last slice in the kitchen and then like come back out. And then maybe even divert them even more when I go out to the kitchen and be like, oh man, who took the last slice of pizza?
So you make a deal on the other side of it.
Mm.
Do you have like a YouTube playlist of like pizza stealing?
Guaranteed videos, crowd pleasers.
Guaranteed like magnetic. But I should. Just like, oh, hey, watch this 3.5 minute video.
No, but I really should.
Okay.
Anyway, I just need to make sure that this was
a good, you know, I think that was a good lightweight conversation.
Fighting the big fight.
That warms us up to get into the meat, the pizza of this podcast, if you will.
And that is
Murder on the Orient Express, the 2010 version.
Yeah. Welcome back.
Very excited for this.
This is part 3 of our Murder on the Orient Express series, where we tackle the book.
Journey, you had an option there. Murder on the Orient Express.
Journey, our train route, where we tackle the novel itself, as well as the subsequent adaptations. In our last episode, we discussed at length the 1974 Albert Finney adaptation.
What was that last episode? It was like 2.5 hours.
It was like 1:50, I think. And directed, oh, and I do need to make an apology. Directed by Sidney Lumet, not Plumet. For some reason, the French in me took over. I kept saying Plumet, Plumet, Plumet over and over again. You said Lumet, and then I said Lumet just once. I was like, surely I like adjusted from that point, because I keep talking about how much I admire and love this director.
I love
him. No, I just went right back to Plumet. Somebody on YouTube commented, like, Plumet. And I was like, yeah, I wrote in the description, like, I know I said his name wrong, okay? Like, I know. You don't have to tell me. I know. But
do we have to post an apology video? He'll take a photo of you crying, and that'll
be he's
I'm so sorry, Mr. Plumet.
No, he's dead.
Okay,
but well, anyway,
okay. All due consideration and condolences to a moment of silence for Mr. Plumet.
Anyway,
so yeah. Mr. Lumet.
Lumet,
there we go.
Let's.
I want to get into this. This is one of the shorter versions of the Murder on the Orient Express. It only caps in at about 87 minutes long.
Well,
if you're including credit.
Technically made for TV film. So yeah. That's
one. Because of this, I don't want to talk about it too much. I want to save that for my final thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
The time constraint alone limits. This is not my favorite version of this.
Okay, so let's get into overall thoughts before we jump into everything. Yeah, what are your
fantastic. David Suchet does an amazing job. We all know that this is but I like how I was saving this for the conclusion, but I guess we can get into it now.
It's going to be a really short
episode. One review said this about this episode. So this is actually part of the television series, The Poirot, which expanded. I wanted to go into this real quickly. The Poirot television series that aired from 1989 through 2014.
Yeah.
I didn't realize they had such a long production run. Like
25 years.
That's insane. Mm-hmm. And the fact that David Suchet played the entire thing.
Yep.
There was over 25 directors throughout this series. Most of them only got like one or two episodes each.
Mm-hmm.
This was written by Agatha Christie, but the screenplay was developed by Stuart Harcourt.
Yes.
Who had a very long history of doing like television screenplays. A lot of them are like British dramas.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see like where his expertise comes in on this. But even like the director, Philip Martin, this is his only episode that he did. Whether it was the director's choice or the writer's, this is a very different kind of Poirot.
Yes.
One review said this. They said the darker tone in the final seasons received mixed reactions, with some feeling it detracts from the original charm.
Mm-hmm.
So just with that initial judgment.
Yes.
There are parts of this that just confused me, because I'm like, that wasn't in the book. That was not in the book. And anyway, I'll save that for the final fights. So
But generally, too, I had to kind of like the opening sequences were just so shocking. It was like, whoa.
To like recalibrate your mind. It's like,
I need to reset like what I expect from this movie, this episode, this Poirot, this kind of Poirot, the storytelling and everything. So going into it was a bit jarring. Jarring.
Yeah. Yeah, I forgot my tablet today, guys, so I have to print my notes like a barbarian. But yeah, I was really like, I knew this was going to be good because the series, the whole Poirot series, viewing it as a whole, is so faithful to Agatha Christie's tone and stories with like usually just minor experiences, minor changes. And I was like, also, David Suchet, like, I'm never going to complain about David Suchet. All that being said, I hate this. I
that bad?
Hate it. I really hate it.
So much.
And
much anger.
Because it's just, there's a lot of major deviations from the source material. It's just a
unnecessary deviation.
Yeah. And it's just a joyless experience. Now, I'm not stupid. I know it's not supposed to be a happy experience, this story. It's a tragedy.
Wow.
But this story is also famous for like really playing into the closed door whodunit setting. And a murder mystery is also supposed to be fun to experience, like solving, because it's just that air of mischief. And that's what makes the 1974 version work so well. They play into the tragedy, yes, and the drama, but they also do play into the theatrics of it. This, they just make it as morbid as humanly possible, mainly because of how Poirot himself is written. It's not, I'm not criticizing David Suchet. His performance is on point as always. No. But if you've watched any other of the Poirot series installments, this is the most unlikable Poirot we have ever seen. And it doesn't make me want to rewatch it. There is still a lot to appreciate in this adaptation. There's a lot of faithful elements. I just overall didn't have a great time. And
I'm just going to go out and say, so far in our, I mean, we're only
three. We've only done.
But so far, this is my least favorite.
We've reviewed two movies, so yes.
I mean, yeah. We're going to have to do like a rank up of one of them. But this one's definitely not do again, it, which is killing me because David Suchet is my favorite.
He is, yeah.
He is ostensibly the fan base's favorite, what's the word?
Portrayal
of Hercule Poirot.
Yeah.
But it's just confusing because the whole performance and stuff is confounding.
It's really,
like, this is not the man that I don't think it stays true to the Poirot universe.
No, not only in the book, but not even, it's inconsistent with the Poirot in the TV series too. And it is, I think Murder on the Orient Express is probably the most difficult story of hers to adapt because it's the most unique mystery. It has the most unique ending.
It has the most character, but it's of most murders.
And it's also the most unique story in the sense that it's one of the only mysteries to happen to Poirot himself. So yes, that in like a movie setting here, there should be a bit of character development for him in that sense, but I just hate how they did it. So we'll
get that. Okay. I think we're good for the initial.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just want to real quick run through some of the production.
Please.
Some of the actors, notable names, obviously David Suchet plays Hercule Poirot.
Mm-hmm.
Serge Hassan Navakias.
Yep.
Plays Xavier Bourg.
Yep. And probably the most faithful portrayal of the book character.
He does an amazing, amazing job. We're going to touch on that a little bit later. Toby Jones plays Samuel Ratchet.
He's one of those actors. You've definitely seen him before.
Yeah.
Maybe you can't name it specifically. Big character actor. Thoroughly hateable as Ratchet. I was like, well done.
Okay,
well,
as far as the Ratchets of in our
theory, he's the most Ratchet Ratchet.
He is the most, like some of the photos they have, like the mugshots. Anyway, we're going to talk about that later. He nails it.
Yep.
Which, when he first came on, I was like, oh, look, it's Toby Jones. I was like, I don't see him as a, because he doesn't play like the bad guy. He's more just the,
sometimes comic relief. He played the villain in one of the Jurassic World movies.
He was the bad guy in, Not Ever After. I forget which one. Like, he just plays kind of like the bumbling villain.
Yeah.
Whereas in this, like, he is just a seriously
evil,
powerful man. Yeah. Brian J. Smith plays Hector McQueen. Mm-hmm. David Morrissey.
Morrissey,
plays John Arbuthnot.
Yes.
Really popular actor in, like, TV shows.
Yeah.
Not movies.
Most of these actors were big in, like, either... There are a lot of actors and actresses in here that are prominent in French media for some reason, but also more so British media. And David Morrissey...
Conversely, though, Jessica Chastain plays Mary Debenham. She's been in a lot of big, like, AAA, The Help, X-Men, mm-hmm. The Martian, a lot of big...
This was right before she became, like, a big movie star. Now she is, like...
This was quite a stepping
stone. Yeah, I was like, that's... I remember, like, watching this, I was like, that's Jessica freaking Chastain! Good for her!
Yeah. She, I don't know, small beginnings, right?
Yep.
Eileen Atkins plays Princess Dragmirnov.
Dragmirnov.
I always say that. I want to say Dragon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Susan Lothar plays Hildegard Schmidt.
Yeah, I have to pause there. She is an actual German actress. I don't know her from anything, but sadly, she took her own life 2 years later after making this movie at the age of 51. So thank you, Susan, for all you did.
Dennis Menochet, yep. I guess you say, plays Pierre Michael.
Michel.
Mm-hmm. Pierre Michel. I don't know.
Pierre Michel.
Bro. Michelle, there you go. Yeah. Barbara Hershey plays Carolyn Hubbard.
I have to pause there. I love Barbara Hershey. No. Barbara Hershey is alive.
Like all these pauses.
She has been in a ton of stuff. She played the mom in Black Swan. She was really big in the 90s as well. Yeah, I know her from more recent projects. She gets a couple of good lines here and there, but I felt she was tragically underused. Here.
Agreed.
Like, for some reason, they shift the focus. Well, we'll get into that. Go on.
Hugh Bonneville plays Edward Masterman.
Mm-hmm. One note for him. I'm sorry.
Please.
I guess he was in Downton Abbey. I do not watch Downton Abbey. My parents love it. I think I watched a couple episodes with them. But in a behind-the-scenes interview, this I thought was funny. He said he was excited to be in this project as he was one of the only actors left in Britain who hadn't been in a Poirot episode yet. Because everybody in Britain was in this show.
This was the 12th season. They've been
this is one of the last
airing for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Moving on, Marie-Josée Croze plays Greta Olsen. Stanley Weber plays Count
Andreini.
Elena Satin plays Countess.
She has been in more notable projects than I realized.
I feel like the Andreini's got such a short.
Yeah.
Green time in this. Mm-hmm. It was almost negligible, their inclusion.
Yeah.
As, like, characters.
Elena Satin.
They did a good job.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did. His delivery was stiff, but...
Elena Satin, she's been in a couple more notable things than I realized. She was in the revival of Twin Peaks, as well as the god-awful live-action Cowboy Bebop series.
No! Mm-hmm. Really?
Mm-hmm. She didn't play Faye.
She must have been desperate.
Yeah.
Go on. And lastly, Joseph... Molly plays Antonio Foscarelli.
Yeah.
Just a note, my least favorite depiction of Foscarelli. He was like a New Jersey Italian.
Well, he also gets maybe like 10 lines in this thing.
It's
pretty short. You forgot one person. Samuel West as Dr. Constantine. Oh,
sorry, I had that in my...
So they nix the character of Cyrus Hardman and combine like his... plot lines with Foscarelli and I think a little bit with Constantine. But that was the only, I just have a couple production notes. We'll talk about that.
I want to talk about that a little bit later in the show, but that's the whole cast. Mm-hmm. A great cast. Mm-hmm. The saddest part about this is like they have really like notable names for TV dramas, for movies. It's just so short.
This is the most underutilized cast because, unfortunately, we spend more time with Poirot than any of them.
We spend more time with Ratchet.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to talk about that later on in Act 1.
Just a couple of quick production notes. If you have watched the Poirot series leading up to this, you notice there is a drastic change with this series beginning in its 9th season. Because they changed executive producers. Oh. Like, the early seasons are a little more, I hate this word, but campy. And more like, formulaic, almost like, you know, lighthearted. Poirot has Hastings, Miss Lemon, Inspector Japp.
With this whole series, one of the
hallmarks.
One of the issues a lot of people had with it was that all of the episodes felt formulaic. Mm. Like they had the introduction, they had the intro, they had the thing, Poirot solves it, which I'm like, okay, it's a murder mystery.
Right.
What do you expect?
Well, so starting with the 9th season, the new executive producers, Michelle Buck and Damian Timmer, they made the creative decision to shift the series to a darker, more gritty tone.
It was past season 10?
Yes. So starting in season 9. So we're in season 12 here.
When
2001. Mm-hmm. And the early series are more, you know, they're lighter, they're cozier. But he flies solo in these. Not everybody liked the darker episodes. I personally love them.
Nice.
Well, because they make for a more cinematic viewing experience. High production value. They play...
The production? Mm-hmm. For being a television... I mean, obviously, this was a huge episode for them, and they covered it in season 12, episode 2, 3, 3.
Yeah.
It was a little confusing. I'm like, they spent a lot of money. I felt bad for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
But the production value, some of the, mm-hmm. I have a couple of notes later on. The CGI, the camera, just some of the stage work. Fantastic.
Yes.
They sunk a lot of cash.
There are a lot of things to love about this adaptation. The later episodes of Poirot, like we see here, they do play up Poirot being super religious, maybe a little too much, but it's still...
Yeah.
I like them.
It's about that a little
later. In this case, it's definitely a bit much for my liking. But the screenwriter, Stuart Harcourt, he said, Orient Express is probably the most famous whodunit ever written, where most of the world knows the outcome. So the challenge was to find a way of engaging an audience in the drama for 2 hours when they already knew the end. Now, I understand that. I completely disagree with it, because watching this, it comes off like the creators assume you already know the ending, which shouldn't you be writing everything for the perspective of a first-time viewer?
That's part of the joy in rewatching, like watching a remake, in that you kind of know... I think that's what made Hitchcock so good, and his whole thing why they were thrillers and not horror was because he told you the whole, you knew both sides, and the thrill came from the cat, watching the cat and the mouse.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you were to only ever watch the cat, it would be very dramatic. Or if you were only to watch the mouse, like it's just kind of just horror, terrifying. Yeah. But this whole thriller, knowing the story helps you enjoy the story. I don't agree with the direction, especially watch... Like, anyway.
I'll get into it.
I just want to get into
my final note on for the production. I do like the musical score. I like how they play into the rhythmic train, feel of it. But I feel like this is a good time to take a break. Let's take a break, folks. And when we come back, we are going to start diving into the plot.
I'm just going to say it. This introduction... This intro, two or three bits, is wild. Just the whole ride. We're introduced right at the start. Like most Poirot shows, the introduction matters. Some of the sequences, the scenes, they prepare you for the conclusion. They get you ready for either they give you evidence or kind of a backstory or a moral dilemma that's going to come up later. And this one leans into it hard. We are not introduced to the Armstrong family. We are not introduced to anyone.
Nope.
Daisy, nor the father, nor the wife.
We're
not introduced to anyone. We are introduced to Poirot solving a case, I'm assuming in Istanbul, where you don't know any of the facts. You just know the lieutenant made a decision, and now he shoots himself because he's been found out.
Well, it's the case that's alluded to at the start of the book. Like, he's just coming off a case that he solved. They're thanking him. But yeah, immediately, the opening shot is Poirot screaming at this guy, just completely unhinged. And it throws you for a bit of a loop, because if you've watched the series, we do see Poirot get a little worked up in past cases. But this is just so much more enraged, and I don't get it. Because he's mad that the lieutenant lied to him, But even then, plenty of people have lied to Poirot in the past, and he's maintained his composure. But maybe the show is trying to show us by this point, he's getting older, and he's just so over it.
He's so unhinged. I have to admit, David Suchet does a fantastic job at portraying just an enraged, not out of control, but enraged man. His act, again, amazing actor. Mm-hmm. So you're immediately confronted with this cinematic presentation of when Poirot does something that trying to bring justice adversely affects. People take justice into their own hands. Like this guy, he doesn't wait for a court. He just shoots himself,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I guess they're trying to hint at, like, has never happened before for Poirot. Like, this is a first off.
Yeah.
Later on, they're walking through Istanbul.
Well, I want to talk about his exchange on the ship with the lieutenant. We get his awkward exchange that he has in the book with the lieutenant, where he's like, oh, okay, yeah, we'll be to Istanbul soon. And they're discussing the case he solved. But this time, the lieutenant says, you know, if I can speak up, I don't think that was right. I don't think, you know, the lieutenant deserved to have that kind of ending. He was a good man. He just, you know, made a mistake. And Poirot is basically like, that's just not my problem. like he's just like, oh, I don't know, not my fault. He made that choice. Tough love, man. I was like,
I mean, he's not wrong.
Man, I'm like, but again, I have to say, like, Poirot, that we know from the books and the series, he's weird and he's
quirky.
But like, it's like you need a disclaimer at this point. If you came into this expecting the quirky,
I'm sorry, the Poirot that I've known for the last 11 seasons.
Right. If you came in expecting the quirky, sometimes difficult, yet still charming and empathetic man you've come to know and love, just know that man is gone. He will not be making an appearance tonight.
I'm sorry, Poirot can't come to the phone right now. We're like dead.
Yeah. And in his place is this callous, unlikable, joyless man who now just sees things as black and white. You will not see him smile at all in this movie.
Yeah, throughout the movie, his just, like, love affair with justice.
Yeah.
I was like, it's a bit obsessive.
Like, Poirot loves the law, but he still has a shred of compassion.
Yeah.
And this was...
The book highlighted. At the end of the book, he just has, like, okay, I have this horrible moral dilemma. I'm not going to decide. I leave it to the train's owner. Like, this is on you, bro.
It was this scene. We started watching this, and my wife, Samantha, said, are you sure this is Orient Express? Should I say that?
Jesse said the same thing. I put it on, and she's like, are you sure this is the right episode? I
was
like, yes. And then the title came on. It was like, Murder on the Orient Express. And you're like, I feel like that's wrong.
That's exactly what happened. Samantha was like, are we sure? Like, this is the right movie? And I was like, yes, it is. And she did not believe me until the opening title said Murder on the Orient Express. And she had the same reaction. She said, oh, okay.
Even then, I checked the title. And I was like, it's got to be wrong. This has got to be like an ad for the show. No.
This is, yeah. Anyway, continue. What happens next?
So we see Poirot walking through Istanbul, following a man and a woman. They talk about walking to the train. There's a scuffle, a kerfuffle, if you will.
It's a light way of putting it. Yeah.
A woman is being chased by a man, and the townspeople, the mob forms, they drag her away. It's, I mean, shocking. Like, literally, like, this mob forms right in front of this couple, and they drag the woman away, like, kicking and screaming. And then we find out later it's Mary Debenheim. She's like, what happened? And John is like, she had a child, but with another man.
She's pregnant.
Well, they drag her away and start stoning her. And they follow and watch.
Yeah.
So they go, and then later on, they're shocked. They're talking about it. Like, Mary's on the verge of tears. John's trying to console her, being like, hey, we got to get to our train. The whole time, Poirot's just kind of in the back frowning.
Poirot's watching, like, is there anything else on?
Like, it's like, this is okay. So they,
yeah, but it's like, it's meant to,
it just goes by
fast. And I get what they were trying to do, that, like, with that as well as the opening case, they're trying to establish Poirot's controversial views on justice. But it's what are we watching?
It was a aggressive way to introduce your audience to moral dilemma.
Yes,
okay, it's like, in this case, justice is being dealt. But
like, but at the hands of an angry mob.
And this woman is stoned. And the screenwriter justified this by saying, well, there is evidence of things like this happening at that time. Okay. Okay, fine. Yeah. Anyway.
Moving. Okay, so we cut to the Tocatlian Hotel in Istanbul, where Poirot is about to check in. He receives a telegram prompting him to immediately cancel his hotel stay. He books a ticket on the, well, he asks the hotel clerk to book him a ticket on the Orient Express the same day in order to return to England. There's a little back and forth. There's no tickets available, mm-hmm. but Poirot actually runs into, well, I guess, Monsieur Bloch.
Book.
Book. He recognizes Poirot. Now, in this adaptation, I don't know, in the book, they recognize each other. And they're like, oh, hey, how's it going? I love you, man. How can I? And he's like, oh, come with me on the train. In this, Poirot doesn't recognize him.
Why did they do that?
I don't know.
I said, I was like, why is this so awkward? Because in the book, yeah, it's well established. They're old friends, like from Poirot's policeman days.
It's like, hey, Poirot, how's it going? It's so good to see you. And Poirot's like, I'm so sorry. Who are you?
And this was one of the, I had the book with me as I was watching this. In the book, Poirot is the one who recognizes him first. Here, it's like, it's like he's pretending to know him. Or the writer on this one again? Stuart Harcourt.
Stuart. What the hey, bro?
Stuart. I was like, this is Stuart. I'm like, why is he like, it comes off like Poirot is pretending to remember who he is. It was an odd choice.
It was an awkward, okay.
Well, anyway, short. We're boarding the train. It's
Xavier. They never referred to him through the end. Anyway.
Right, yeah.
X here. X. They're super tight. Like, he insists. He's like, you have to be on this train. You must be on this train. And Poirot's like, I'll just catch the one tomorrow. And Book is like, no, you get on my train. I come always on. Have space for people like you.
Okay.
And Poirot's like, okay, sure. I'm going to get on the train.
Yeah.
The sequence for them to get on the train is so fast.
It's very clunky.
It is so rushed and... I was almost getting nauseous the way the camera was cutting back and forth. They get to the train. They talk to the what's the guy's name?
Pierre Michel.
The concierge.
Yeah.
And they're like, this is an old friend of mine. He has to get on the train. And the dude's like, bro, we don't have any room. We don't have any room.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, there has to be space. Put him with McQueen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this was a... Like I said, this whole sequence, it's very clunky was the best word I could find to describe it. We don't see everyone even bored. We only see like half of them. A
handful of people.
And, but we do get a reference. Mrs. Hubbard says, you can't take that spot. Mr. Harris is coming. He bought a ticket. And I had to go back to the book for that because I was like, I don't remember this. Is this like an added element? But it was in the book because they couldn't risk getting a stranger added in at the last minute to board with McQueen.
The ticket under an alias.
Yeah.
However, by the time they depart, mm-hmm. Mr. Harris doesn't arrive to McQueen's chagrin.
Well, so yeah, they were just like, oh, I guess this Mr. Harris isn't coming. Let's just go.
Now, in the book, they say that, I forget how they describe it, whether it's narrated or just described, but they were like, oh, the concierge just was hoping for a large tip from him for saving, like holding the room so that way McQueen has a room to himself. And I did enjoy this bit. They get on the train and the camera here, the they spend like 2 or 3 minutes actually showing McQueen and Poirot in the cabin,
yeah,
trying to get ready for bed in this tiny little cabin, like unpacking, trying to open up and use the refresher, climbing, like getting in pajamas and getting ready for bed, and it's just awkward, the whole energy, because I mean the space is tiny.
Well, I think they did a very good job capturing just how claustrophobic a train like this feels. I'm like, you know what, I appreciate that. Actually, I love that you call it the refresher like they do in Star Wars.
It was the first word that came to mind, because the thing is, that's not like a bathroom.
It's not a full bathroom. I was looking to see, I was like is there a toilet? But I think they only have a toilet at the end of the hallway. But
this was like a yeah. sink and a mirror.
But the Mr. Harris element, it wasn't in the 1974 version, but it was in the book. I don't think it was in 1974. But McQueen, he isn't happy with this. But I did like this little hint. Pierre Michel looks McQueen dead in the eyes and says, "This is what has to happen." It's like, oh, okay. The exteriors of the train traveling through the snow at night or during the day, I actually did really like. And the music, it's not like the upbeat, majestic style of the 1974, but it works on its own merit.
Sorry, this sequence was, it felt, and I like your word, clunky. It was so rushed. Mm. It was like, boom, we're going to get on the train.
Yeah.
Boom, we're going to have Poirot on the road. Boom, we're going to cut wide shot to the train traveling at night. It was like, okay, we're on the train. We're moving. We're here now.
But I did like, whereas 1974, it was showing the train going through the, you know, landscapes and making it feel like grand and elegant. This one just like leans into the darkness, like, bah, 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 bah. Like, oh yeah, something's about to go down.
It's crane.
of the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
If they are, it's just like snow-capped,
yep.
like a blurry blizzard.
Yeah. Poirot does have this very interesting exchange with Mary Debenham. I don't know if you're about to say that.
I don't have any notes on that. But
yeah.
So they have a little. It's. I don't remember this in the book.
It's not in the.
This is completely.
This is not in the book. He witnesses Ratchet basically making a pass at Mary Diddingham. Yeah, and then she comes down the hallway. Poirot asks Mary Debenham, "Are you all right?" The literal one time in this entire movie where he shows a shred of compassion, and. Then they discuss the incident in Istanbul. He's like, you know, I hope you weren't too upset by that. And she's like, yeah, I'm still upset. And
the whole time she's like on the verge of tears.
And he says, well, justice is often upsetting to witness, like a pompous punk. I was like, and she's like, what? And so they have a back and forth about that. He does mention it's best not to intervene with the ways of another culture. And I do agree with him.
I agree with that. Yeah, he has a line there about, like, they do things differently in different cultures, and it's not for us to judge
them. Yeah. He's like, yeah, I mean, it was upsetting, but whatevs. I was like, okay.
It just seems so confusing. Yeah. You're like, all right. I'm going to move past this bit.
He introduces himself to Greta Olsen afterwards. He's like, "An Hercule Poirot." And as she walks away, he like says it to himself again, like reassuringly. He's like, "Hercule Poirot."
Okay.
I was like,
I thought that was a bit awkward. I was like, who is he talking?
They're trying to show his growth. Like, I don't know, like reassuring himself. Yeah.
This man is just slowly becoming unhinged.
Anyway.
So they blitz through the dinner scene on the train, at which they kind of show Ratchet awkwardly sitting by himself. They show Monsieur Book talking to Poirot. He orders champagne for the whole train. There's this awkward bit here with... Oh, I know. That's at breakfast. Fast forward. Poirot's just standing in the dark, and Ratchet awkwardly approaches him asking for help.
Yep.
He's like, I need your help. You know, you're gonna... And he, you know, he doesn't ask. Like, he just tells him the whole time.
You're gonna do...
People, there's bad people that hate me, and they're gonna do me harm. So here's a whole stack of money. You help me protect me. And Poirot's like, I don't need your money. I am... What does he say?
I'm not playing poker with you.
I'm not playing poker with you.
I don't know if you know how poker works, but...
And so Ratchet throws down, like, a second stack of money, and eventually he, like... pouts and he goes off in a huff because he can't buy off Poirot.
Well, this time he doesn't even give Ratchet an answer why. He just looks so miserable.
He won't even meet him in the eye.
I was like, is it bad that I actually kind of sided with Ratchet in this scene?
Kind of.
What's your problem, man?
Okay, if you knew they were going to, like, you've been getting threatening notes, you know someone's coming after you, yeah, I would be asking the world's best detective to help. Anyway. Then comes this whole sequence. It's like 5 minutes of Poirot and Ratchet side by side, kind of camera work, praying before they go to bed. It's long. It's arduous. I think it's overdone. Stewart or the director or somebody in between.
Someone is to blame.
Issues with like God and religion. And
anyway, the later episodes of Poirot like show him talking about being Catholic a lot more. Yeah, and it is, like, alluded to in the books. It is mentioned. But it's like Ratchet on one hand is asking for forgiveness, I guess. Poirot, in the meantime, is praying, thank you for making me awesome. And I'm like, why are we, what are we doing here?
It's just,
what are we doing here?
I feel like they really overblew this whole, anyway.
And I have to say, as much flack as I'm giving Poirot himself, I do need to give another shout out to David Suchet. This is not his fault. I know he, like, he had some say in, like, how Poirot was portrayed. But even on my way here, I was listening to a behind-the-scenes featurette about the Poirot series.
Of course you were.
Of course I was. David Suchet, he put his heart and soul into this character. When he first started playing him, like, even before they started shooting the series, he, over time, read every single book and short story written about Poirot. And he also made, like, a dossier of sorts. Like, he started writing down every single character trait of Poirot's that he could find in the books.
That's amazing.
He ended up coming up with a list of 93.
Like, ticks.
Ticks, traits, personality, habits. Like, oh, always wipes a chair before sitting down in it.
This guy.
He spent time, like, perfecting his walk. He showed how easily he can now slip in and out of the Poirot voice. When you hear him talk, it does not sound like Poirot at all. It sounds like just the regular Englishman.
Yeah.
And the process of, like, he's like, Poirot does not feel with his heart. He feels with his mind. So the voice is all about going into the mind. And it's like, he's brilliant.
This is amazing.
So,
again,
this is not his
factor.
Fault. Yeah.
I don't know if it was Stewart or Philip. Somewhere in between.
Stewart.
Stu. We're going to have a very long talk.
Yeah.
Get home. So there's this whole sequence.
The train gets that up.
Boarding.
Yep.
Poirot goes to bed. He's awoken at 12:37 or 23 minutes before 1 a.m. He hears a cry. There's a loud noise. Poirot, like, cracks the door. Very large. He, like, opens the door to see what's going on. You see the concierge at the door. And there's a voice that calls out, it's okay. Everything is all right, in French. Mm-hmm. I made a mistake. It was nothing. I was mistaken. A couple of minutes later, Poirot tries to go back to bed. Miss Hubbard rings the bell urgently. Ding, 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 ding. And eventually, Poirot he calls the concierge. He comes over. He's like, hey, can I have some more mineral water? I know, like, we just crashed into a pile of snow, but can I have some more water? And he's like, what happened with Miss Hubbard? And she's like, she thought there was a man in her cabin, you know, like a crazy person.
Yeah.
I'm like, dude, you're not going to take any.
Nope.
Anyway.
But also looking like the train gets stuck. And I was like, man, that thing is stuck.
Dude, there was this whole sequence. The train comes to a screeching halt. Nobody even freaks out. Like, the plates crash off the tables. The glass shatters. And Poirot just kind of goes, hmm.
Yeah.
He's like, something happened.
Yeah.
And the guys, like, up by the train are, like, screaming and shouting. They're pulling out shovels. And you see kind of a wide shot of the train. And it's, like, buried. It is buried.
It's not going anywhere.
Yeah. They're stuck there for the next couple of days.
Yeah.
Fast forward a couple of minutes. Poirot is again awoken by a bang at his door. He gets up, cracks the door, and he sees a woman in a scarlet kimono retreating down the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks, nothing of it, whatever. He goes back to bed. I think at this point, I consider this act two, because it's like the more...
Well, I feel like the end of this is the end of act. I feel like act one is when the murder happens.
Okay.
Act two is when we begin our investigation.
Okay.
I'd say we reach the end of act one.
So at this point...
Well, at this point...
I'm going to go... Because we haven't found out there is a murder.
So, oh, okay. Go on.
So... Poirot, it cuts to, like, the sun is up. Poirot, like, starts lighting his little wax heating kit. He starts preparing for the day. He gets his little mustache kit going, only to have Mr. Book bust into the room, like, unlock the door, break in. Poirot's like, I said just a minute! And Mr. Book is like, you need to come right now. He demands his help, because Mr. Ratchet, and they go down. The concierge is like, I just checked. He wasn't waking up. So they all, like, all six heads pop into the door. And there's Ratchet just sitting on the bed, covered in blood. The window's open. Snow is pouring in. And you're like, Mr. Ratchet has been stabbed. That's like... Okay. And at that point, everyone's kind of looking at Poirot like,
all right, get to
do your thing. Yeah,
no, this is your thing.
Yeah.
And now we realize there's been a murder.
Yep. That's the end of Act One. And we're going to take a short break. And when we get back, we are going to delve into Act Two, the investigation.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right, we're back. And we are starting our investigation. I don't think we need to take it like, you know, meticulous scene by scene. You know how this goes down for the most part. My one, first major note, I meant to mention it earlier. When we are first introduced to Dr. Constantine, like during the lunch scene or dinner scene, whatever time it was, he says, oh, you're Hercule Poirot, the famous detective. And then he has this, I've clearly got something to hide face. And that never goes away. And as they're examining the body, for me, it became really obvious at this point why this change to Dr. Constantine does not work. Because he, spoiler alert, is in on it. He has taken the place of Hardman. He is one of the conspirators in the murder now. He takes every chance he can to misdirect Poirot. Oh, wow, he must have escaped through the window. Oh, wow, murderer must have just come in here and gone crazy and stabbed him 15 times. Oh, AZ arms? That doesn't mean anything, right? Let's just ignore that. And
whereas in the book, Dr. Constantine was kind of the reader. It was the sound logic, like, well, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I was like,
in this, you know, it's clearly misdirection.
And I know I said previously that I didn't feel that he was the most necessary character. But on one hand, Poirot is not a forensics expert, so it does make sense. Like, okay, there should be a doctor there. But he worked in the book and the last movie as a neutral party, like someone else for Poirot to bounce off of.
Yeah.
But here in this movie, his presence is just more distracting and annoying than anything. Like, you're more distracted by him than the actual evidence. He's even interrupting Poirot while he's questioning people. Like, Poirot's like, oh, Pierre Michel, oh, your wife died? And Dr. Constantine is like, leave him alone. I was like, okay, you can go. You can go away now if you're going to be like this.
I do not like this change of pace.
Yeah, I hated it.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Not only did he seem stupid and distracting, but I don't, anyway, yeah, I have some real issues with the character merge there of Hardman and Constantine.
It doesn't work.
So we get into the room. They're starting to examine stuff. Constantine talks about the stab wounds, the window, the time on the watch. He claims the person must have fled through the open window. Poirot immediately is like, yeah, that ain't didn't happen. There's no tracks in the snow. Because when did we stop? 2 o'clock? Okay, yeah, there's no, the murderer is still here.
Yeah,
we see the whole thing, and it moves pretty quickly. Poirot talks about the stab wounds, left hand, right hand, the scratches, left hand. They find the match on the ashtray, the gun in Ratchet's hands, the handkerchief on the floor, the button, all of it, like, pretty quickly. We see the famous bit with the hat boxes. What's it? Book goes in, he's like, ah, ladies, we need 2 hat boxes. So they get it. This, I think, was actually my favorite portrayal of the paper. Not like the setup and everything, but the way, because you only see AZ arms for like half a second.
It's very fast.
Whereas in the other ones, it kind of like glows and glimmers and you can read it. Whereas in this, like, you understand why he had the whole process of getting the hat boxes.
Yeah.
They
also make the choice to raise the stakes in this adaptation by having the train lose power and having it gradually get freezing cold in there to keep things dark and freezing for some reason.
I do not like this change because in the book, there was no conversation about the heating, the electricity, the plumbing, anything. Whereas in this, it becomes such a critical part of the, like, everyone's like by the end shivering.
Well, then at the end, Jessica Chastain's like, Princess Dragomiroff made everyone tea.
I'm like, how?
I thought you were all dying.
She's made tea from the snow.
Like, with her...
What?
She just, like, you know, with her breath. Like, how? But it's gradually revealed.
So it's at that point Poirot ascertains that Ratchet is Cassetti. Who is like, who's Cassetti? Because this is the first time we're being introduced to Cassetti, the Armstrong murder, and they do, like, a couple of... like newspaper clippings,
kind of like from the 1974.
It's a very but it's all like you can't read any of the clippings.
Yeah.
It's all under this like weird, like
I think
spotted red.
I think because they were trying to hide
the actors' faces in the pictures, but
probably. So they talk about how Cassetti kidnapped and murdered the famous Daisy Armstrong. The father was so grief stricken he killed himself. The mom,
We know what happened. We know.
So we move on to the investigations. They go to the dining car. He slowly chips through all of the guests, having them come into the private dining section in order to investigate them individually. This was one of the fastest. I think, again, it's just because of the time of the film. But they run through these people so fast that you really only pick up like the critical details.
Not even everybody gets interviewed.
No, who did they? Because they don't interview
Foscarelli, the Italian. He has a quick exchange with him in the hallway. That's it. They don't sit him down and ask him questions.
Sounds like he's threatening him the whole bit there.
Colonel Arbuthnot doesn't really get a formal interview. Like Poirot just mainly asks about the connection between him and Mary Debenham. One thing of note: Barbara Hershey as Mrs. Hubbard. She does have a line in here that if she had known Ratchet was Cassetti, she would have ripped out his heart herself. Now, this is actually beautifully ironic because 2 years later, Barbara Hershey would go on to play the Queen of Hearts in Once Upon a Time, the TV show, a villain who would rip people's hearts out. And so it's not as graphic as you would think. It's like they're, I don't know. But
cartoonish, maybe?
Yeah.
Light and whimsical.
I was like, oh, the irony. But I have to say, Barbara Hershey is a great Mrs. Hubbard, but her time is monopolized by other people. When they find the button, Dr. Constantine gets this very long monologue posing the theory that it was a separate person who came onto the train, and he goes on for a while, and even Poirot, you can tell, is annoyed. He's like, thanks. But I wasn't expecting to be this angry about the change to Constantine, but it's not that him posing this theory is wrong. That's what, even in the book, they want Poirot to think. But giving Constantine all of this screen time takes away screen time from our other
characters.
Yeah, from the actual characters, which is a shame. And oh my God, he's so annoying.
You're really going to stay with that, eh?
I really am.
Okay. So we run through most of the characters for interviews, their name, their history, their passport, very quickly, like literally just enough in order to connect the pieces. And then Poirot's like, all right, Cinco, next. You know, the train cabs themselves, so well done. This whole thing was actually filmed on a stage studio in Malta, mm-hmm. which is kind of sad. I'm like, they could have filmed in, like, Malta? No.
It looks fantastic. It really does. They keep a couple of faithful elements. They keep Book's prejudice against the Italian.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it had to be him. The actress who plays Greta Olsen, Mary Jose Crozet. She has kind of a chunky scene where she and Poirot discuss religion, and it's not as gripping as the Ingrid Bergman scene from the 1974, but it at least gets the debate going.
But they have this whole conversation about, damnation and sins that can be forgiven and sins that can't be forgiven. And I don't remember this in the book.
It wasn't in the book.
It was definitely this. And again, like, just laying head with Stewart. Bro, you should be a therapist or something, man. This is not healthy.
Mary Debenham goes up to him eventually. She's like, why haven't you questioned me yet? And so he's like, well, what were you talking about with the when it's all over, thing? I will say, I feel this is the only adaptation to get their dynamic right.
This nailed it, because in previous series, Poirot just digs in on Mary Debenham so hard that what... what's his name? Arbuthnot has to jump in there. Whereas in this, Poirot is just being, obviously she's a little sensitive, but he's just being a little aggressive.
But he does start to cross the line. I was like, since when does Poirot ever say things like, don't cross me?
It seemed a bit, for David Suchet, it seemed that much. Then eventually he came in, he explained the whole situation. He's like, even he was like, I can't believe I'm explaining this to you all.
Arbuthnot interrupts. He explains, oh, my wife and I are divorcing. Mary and I want to, get together. But I was like, it's weird. For me, as the investigation goes on over time, it just loses momentum.
Yeah.
He doesn't even have a sit down with everyone, which I get it. Time constraints for a TV movie, probably. And we even get an early reveal of Mrs. Hubbard removing her wig to reveal an even worse, okay, less convincing wig.
Okay, I want to talk about this for a second.
But it's like so much energy by that point is lost.
Yes, no, I mean,
a bit. So much energy is lost by the time she brings Poirot the knife. And Constantine, of course, has to say, oh, wow, that must be the knife. Poirot, and even we as the audience are like, so? Like, I'm losing interest.
You know, what does he say there? He's like, give it, I forget what he says, but it basically it's like, give it a rest.
Like, add it to the list. Oh, no, that's later. That's later. But
So eventually it gets, like, you can kind of tell, like, the day's winding down, the sun is setting. They all gather in this, and the production-wise, whereas in the book they gather in the dining car, in this they gather in a bar car because it's easier to shoot because it was a bigger space. So they're kind of in that more round circle sitting arrangement. So they're talking at, they're talking to each other, and they're just kind of huddling around candles because now the power is out, the heating is gone, they're freezing, and they're just kind of winding down. And Poirot is just, like, you know he knows.
He's like, all right.
I feel like this is the first adaptation that, like, he's known the entire time from AZ Arms.
Well, I think, yeah. By the...
Whereas in this, he's just kind of pieced it together. Whereas in the other one, you don't know.
Right.
Like, in the other adaptations in the book, because there's enough, and maybe just because the story is long enough, they're throwing enough other red herrings at him to distract him and stuff. He's trying to piece it together. Whereas in this, he just seems, the whole thing, he seems frustrated.
He seems so annoyed. And that leads us to the big reveal. That is the end of Act Two. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, it's on to the third and final act, as well as our final thoughts. We'll see you soon.
All right. Well, here we are back with Act Three.
Yes. It's a big reveal.
They are sitting here in the dining car, bar car.
Bar car. The car.
Just kind of waiting out the night. And Poirot at this point is just kind of... There's not even like a... In typical Poirot fashion, like, gather in a circle, I'm going to tell you what happened.
Right.
In the book, at least, they're like, Poirot, like, tell us what you've discovered.
Or he's like, gather everyone. I've...
No, yeah. He's just... Again, he just seems tired.
In the book, he says, gather everyone. In this, he's like... Okay, here's what happened. And we get our...
done.
He puts forth...
Murder.
He puts forth two solutions, but this time, yeah, there's, like, not even any suspense. They, again, tried to...
Oh, deflating.
They tried to raise the tension by, like, oh, they've lost power. But what it actually did was drain power from the...
power went out of the...
And they even said, like, though, oh, losing power, Poirot is, like... He's not used to being this uncivilized. I don't get it. But and as he reveals everyone's link to the case, there's no tension, there's no buildup or reaction of any kind from anyone. Like, everyone's just like, yeah, that's me. Like, all of that is sacrificed in favor of the debate. So, yes, he reveals everybody was in on this. They're all connected to the Armstrong case. And I will say, as far as unveiling the mystery itself, it is still done in a way that's respectful to the audience. They don't tell us anything we didn't see, just things we should have picked up on.
I was rewatching it actually before you came, and the sequence where what's her name is sewing up Miss Dragorov's skirt.
Hildegard.
You see the money.
Yeah.
You see the cash in the skirt.
Oh, in the first scene.
So yes.
Oh, see, I didn't even.
Like, I was like, no. They must have cropped that or something.
Actually, the money was an added element. The money, like the cash, that was not in the book and was unnecessary.
In this, they had Ratchet's
ransom money,
and he had a whole suitcase, and they stole it all to donate it to the
Armstrong fund,
Daisy Armstrong's fund,
like the family fund
for orphaned girls. Maybe it'll pay for Batman's. Maybe.
But I will say the show has always been good at the big reveals.
Yeah.
Like, that's why people one reason why people love the show. My problem is not with that. It's just where they chose to shift their focus. Like, I do appreciate
so deflated because then they quickly, again, Poirot just kind of rattles off everyone's information, and then eventually he looks at Mr. Book and he's like, "Lock me up, lock the door, put me in the little thing so nobody tries to attack me."
Well, before we get there, Oh, I did appreciate Poirot in some sense being so over it. Like when Countess Andreini tries to keep speaking French with him, he's just like, enough, huh?
I love that. Like, I love
like him even acknowledging that Dr. Constantine was trying to deflect him at every turn. I was like, yes, thank you. But so he's like, no, you're all in on this. And I was okay up to that point. Then Princess Dragomirov says, we have Miss Mary Debenham to thank for bringing us all together. I was like, what? Why? Who brings them all together in the book? Mrs. Hubbard, the mother, Linda Arden. And like, this is Mrs. Hubbard's story. I said that in the last review. I'm like, she and Mrs. Hubbard, she, Linda Arden, I should call her. She has a whole long monologue in the book. Like, this was my plan. This, I like, I got them all together.
Builds it. Like, it makes sense.
And it makes sense that this would be her story. Like, don't tell me that this is not her story, because she, everyone in this story has lost something. She has lost the most. She has lost a daughter, a granddaughter, a son-in-law, another grandchild. But somebody in the writer's room said, no, let's make it Mary Debenham. She's the main character of this story. And let's also make the godmother the main character. I'm like, why?
Again, Stuart, what the hey?
Because you're also wasting Barbara Hershey. She's such a good actress. If you watch her in other things, she's so good.
They, again, the priority focus, the shift, and all of this, I feel, came from the writer. Yeah. I don't feel like this was a director's move.
Now, I'm not going to act like the stabbing sequence isn't dark in kind of a delightful way. It is very dark.
It's well.
Like, I understand Dragomirov saying, we needed him to know.
What? Now, if that was like, this was the first adaptation that they really like, no, he's drugged to the point that he's can't move, but he's awake.
He can hear us.
I feel like they've mentioned that in the other ones, but in this, they really dug in. They were like, no, he knew it was us.
Yeah.
And every step, like, you heard him like,
And so they change it where, and so she's like giving him this big speech. But again, to have Dragomirov be the one to talk him through it and not the mother, Linda Arden, makes zero sense to me.
I'm a little bit, the whole bit.
Eileen Atkins, she's a fine enough actress as Dragomirov.
No, but it doesn't.
But I'm like, why?
A godmother?
Yeah. I was like, we need like some Thug Life music playing underneath while she's like, ba, 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 ba.
Little
she's
like, sunglasses.
You had to know we would find you. And,
she has some ratchet lines, if you will.
She's unfazed. But
so I kind of want to keep pace with this whole sequence. So it runs through so fast. Poirot's just like, here it is. He like locks himself in the little room. So they Aberthnot pulls out a gun. He's like, I'm going to shoot Poirot because he's going to sell us out to the cops. Because Poirot's like, justice must be done.
But it's also so hard to watch because Poirot, he goes on like an enraged tirade on these people. Full on screaming, hateful, vindictive, ripping right into them. If you've read any of the books or watched any of the series, Poirot always emphasizes his knack for psychology, understanding why and how people act the way they do. And he even says in previous episodes, "Oh, I do not judge." Here, all of that is gone.
You definitely sound like
that is all gone. Like, this whole adaptation is about retconning his entire character. For some reason. So what does he do? He's like, uphold the law. You're all terrible people. Like,
again, his admiration for not justice, for law, for the law.
I'm like, Poirot we know, he does love the law, but he also has empathy and understanding.
Yeah. This, he seems blind and enraged.
But he's also like, what gives him the right to take control of the train? He's like, no, lock the door. No. I'm like, last I checked, you were a detective, not a cop anymore. But like, he self-righteously appoints himself as like boss of the train. And I get it. Like, I'm just like, what are we doing? I know they want to show his journey, but there had to be a better way. And also, Dragomirov takes Linda Arden's line from the book of turn me into the police. Again, makes zero sense. But
I'm like that bit. She's like, look, I'm old. I'm about to die anyway. Just turn me into the cops. I'll take the heat. Yeah. I'm like, okay, that makes sense.
But also, I understand it gets even more unhinged. Like you said, they decide to make Arbuthnot a homicidal, trigger-happy hothead who's like, oh, no, now we got to kill them, Poirot and Book. And he shoves Mary to the floor. Isn't the whole point to show that these people did a bad thing, but they're also sympathetic and they have a moral code, lines they will not cross?
I have.
So now you're going back.
A lot of questions just with this whole sequence. Eventually, it like fades to black. The next morning, the cops show up. Like, they don't even dig out the train. The local, and this was not the, this was a whole bit in the book. They're like, we don't want to be stuck in Yugoslavia or I forget where. Oh, like, yeah. They're brutal here.
I think it was Yugoslavia.
We need to get through to Prague, I think. Like, we need to get through to the civilized country. And instead, the cops just show up in the snow. And there's this whole sequence. Poirot has to, like, walk through the snow, like, through the crowd, gets to the cops. Well, and they watch him anxiously as he explains to them how there was a man that got on the train and he must have assassinated and then ran out through the window.
And before that, I do have to say, I do actually love the final exchange between Poirot and Mary Debenham, where she's like, you know, what are you going to do, essentially? Because it does help to alleviate tension from the previous scene and provide a little bit of resolution between their characters. She admits, basically, it didn't make her feel better, but she knows she did what she felt was right.
Yeah.
It also helps that Jessica Chastain was in the scene. This woman, she knows how to elicit sympathy, like, and tug at your heartstrings, even down to the way she asks, like, will there be police when the snowplows arrive? Oh, she made tea. I remember her from The Help first. Oh, she was, like, the most sympathetic character in the whole movie. I'm like, dang you, Jessica Chastain. But, they're waiting for Poirot to present his findings, which he does. He goes with the solution they wanted him to go with.
And you never hear him say anything.
No.
You just see him like pointing at the button and pointing at the crowd and then pointing at the train and then walking off with such a... He's almost on the verge of tears.
I think he was.
Just like... Just so sickened by himself as he walks. I'm like, where is he walking?
That's a good point.
Where is he going?
Where are you going?
He's just walking off into the
woods. Don't you still need to be on the train to get
the
home?
The cops like run over to the train and that's it.
Yeah.
And then the credits roll.
Yeah, and by the end of it you're like, I didn't have a good time.
Now, Stuart, if you wanted us all to feel emotionally invested and confused when confronted with moral dilemmas, I understand that. The original Murder on the Orient Express did a wonderful job at that. This just left me confused.
Well, as far as final thoughts go, I'd say yes. As a standalone adaptation, I hate it. I hate it. But you do have to view it in the grand scheme of the show as a whole. And I was watching another YouTube review about this adaptation where this person felt as negatively as we do.
I love that.
There was a comment on this YouTube video from Stuart Harcourt himself.
Whoa!
He's like, he's like, hey, so, yeah, I'm the screenwriter. Because this video, like, ripped right into it, like, this is awful.
I had to make the real underscore Stuart Harcourt.
I'm gonna read his comment.
Okay, please.
He said, Sidney Lumet's wonderful 1974 film is frequently shown on TV in the UK and is a model for the TV series. And we felt that there was no point in trying to replicate it, but to bring something new to it. Also, we were coming to the end of the TV series and we were laying the groundwork for the series finale. What I loved about Orient Express is that Poirot is the main character for once. He isn't merely the deus ex machina who solves the puzzle, but the story actually happens to him. So how does he react? How does it change him? I thought it would be interesting to see this man who has spent his life administering justice have to question who he is and what he's done with his life. The effect of the suicide of the British Army officer and the brutal community justice of the stoning in Istanbul have shaken him profoundly. And then on the train, he's confronted by a murder perpetrated by good civilized people because the justice system has let them down. Poirot's concept of civilization breaks down in our film, literally, from having to share a bedroom with a stranger to the train breaking down and the electricity failing. And he comes face to face with a case that challenges all he has done in his life, all he is. Has it been worth it? Has it been right? Think of our film as Poirot's Hamlet, where he is questioning his very existence.
I get it. I still don't like it.
I have some mixed feelings.
Yeah. I think my final thought is I think they just should have adapted this story much earlier in the show's run, where it was like in its more lighthearted days. Because this
I love the idea of question, like the whole existence thing.
Yeah.
But I don't like how it's changing the same, actually the same issue that affected Flawed, the last Jedi.
Oh.
In that you are fundamental, which I'm very confused actually. Mark Hamill agreed with the change in character. You are fundamentally changing a character's archetype.
Yes.
Like without full explanation. In this, there's two scenes that are supposed to affect like world shift, paradigm shift, Poirot's whole, which we've just met and known for the last 10 seasons, 12 seasons.
Yeah. And it was like,
I get it.
Mm-hmm.
However,
it's one of the most famous murder mysteries of all time because of its theatrical nature.
Yeah.
It should be treated as such. And again, great production value. Some of these cast portrayals are some of my personal favorite portrayals of these characters. But it's just an hour and a half of Poirot not acting like Poirot. Yeah. And, that being the case, go watch the rest of the series because David Suchet is amazing. And also, another great palate cleanser. If you go on YouTube, it is available on YouTube. We have the BritBox subscription. Recently, a documentary, if you could call it that, I guess, was released, David Suchet on the Orient Express.
Oh, I gotta watch.
Because not only before making this movie, mm-hmm. did David Suchet actually go on the Orient Express and read the book to prepare himself. I'm like,
that's fantastic.
Yeah. But he goes back on the Orient Express talking about the history of the train and what the character Poirot means to him. He's so likable. He and his wife have been married for over 50 years.
Aww.
It's like,
I love David Suchet.
So go watch that. It's free on YouTube. But I'm so tired.
I think we've come. I don't even know if we need a final thoughts because we've.
No, I said final thoughts.
Fully expressed them. Not my favorite portrayal of this story.
Well,
I love David Suchet.
Yeah.
Fantastic. The acting in this. I feel like all of the actors got shortchanged just due to time. The acting was pretty. David Suchet's portrayal is amazing. The storytelling, Stewart, man, you got
Stewart.
I don't know if I like the direction that we brought this tale. I do like the change of pace. I do like the idea of the change of pace, but you cannot. I draw the line at fundamentally changing a character.
Well, if you thought this was a wild ride, tune in next time for our review of the 2017 adaptation, which you still haven't seen.
I still have not.
I cannot wait to discuss that with you. And
I can't wait. And neither should you.
Yeah. We will see you next time. Feel free to comment your thoughts if you agree with us, disagree with us. Are we being too harsh? You can also send us an email with any questions, comments, ideas to ondemandmysteries@gmail.com. And we will see you next time on Let's Commiserate.